He's Paul Rees. I am John Dragunas, and you are listening to Double Underscore. Hey, Paul, how are you doing today?
Doing good, John. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have a busy week ahead, or is it a pretty normal week for you?
It is less busy than the last several weeks. I just hit a pretty important milestone on the big project I've been focused on for the last couple of months. So that's a relief. But of course, those kind of breaks never last long. I'm already being pulled into new projects ramping up. So I get a short little breather and then on to the next one.
Hey, sometimes that's all you need. But those kind of weeks are nice, you know, time to catch up on things and all that stuff.
Yeah, and it's not done all the way, but it is nice to just get that sigh of relief from focusing on a big deadline. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep, that makes sense. Good deal. Well, Paul, amazingly, I haven't learned anything this week, but I'm hoping you have.
I have learned something, but sometimes the things you learned don't really seem to help you in the short run. It's like, oh, I learned that if I put my hand on the stove, it melts my skin. That's great, but now I've got a problem. And that's kind of where I am with what I've learned.
Are you saying you did that again after you
did
learned that
again? Or? Yeah. I think the last time I learned that, I was 3. And
oh, good. Well, hopefully you haven't done it recently.
It was pretty recent. Yeah, it was a good reminder. Oh, yeah, stove hot. No, this is something new that I learned. But it feels like I burned my hand in the process. So here's what it is. In screen flows, when you're selecting one or more rows from a screen flow, by default, if you have a table, sorry, I should have been more clear. When you have a table in a screen flow and you want to select one or more rows of that table, by default, that table has variables that are saved without really changing anything. You also have the option, if you want to say, no, I want to manually assign those variables. And it seems like it shouldn't really matter. Like, why would I want to manually assign the variables? So here's what I learned is that if you don't, and you just leave the variables as they are, the good part about that is you can use that to conditionally display other elements on the screen once the user like selects a row or two. So in my example, I was building a screen flow where I'm presenting a table, and if they select a row, then it means that they want to update the record that that row represents, actually potentially more rows. And so if they do, then I want to show them conditionally some extra fields to say, all right, you're going to update those rows. Here are the fields that you can edit on those records. What do you want the field values to be? So I'm conditionally displaying those elements, and that works great.
You're not showing that in the data table. I assume you're showing it in like a second screen or like a...
It's in the area. Same screen, but it's just like two pick lists right beneath it. So
okay.
Once you
okay. I was going to say, you're about ready
row,
to blow my mind otherwise.
No, then two pick list fields okay. show okay. separately. And it's just like every row you select, they'll all be updated with these values, whatever you pick.
Okay.
So
okay.
No problem. But then later on in the flow, what I'm trying to do is I have a decision that says, hey, I want to know if they selected a row there. And the problem is the variable, the default variable cannot be null. So if you do a test like a decision that says, hey, if that variable is not null, meaning they selected a row, then take me down a different path. The problem is those variables aren't null. It's a collection variable like selected rows, but if you do a null test on it, it just doesn't recognize it. It thinks it's like an open and closed bracket, which is different than null. And so I can't really use it for a decision. And I tried a bunch of different ways to say, well, if the text value is open and closed bracket, like I couldn't get it to work. So what I found was if I manually define the variables in actual variables that I define, then later on in the flow, I can use that in my decision logic because those can be null. It's like a single record variable or a record collection variable. Both can be null. So perfect. Now I've fixed my decision element in my flow. But when I go back to the screen, now I can't conditionally display those two pick list fields. I can't make them appear when you select one or two rows. So it's like I get one feature or the other, but I can't have both.
And why won't it let you conditionally display them once you fix the decision piece?
I can't tell, like, technically specifically why, but the way it's behaving, I'm inferring that it doesn't actually set those variables until you click next and leave the screen. And so the manually defined variables, I don't think get populated when you click on a row. I think they get populated when you click next. And so there's just no live interaction available on the screen based on selecting a row.
Right. So prior, you were predefining the variables, and so it worked in the conditional message. You stopped predefining them, and then it broke the conditional message. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. I've had the decision tree issue before, and I never quite connected why, other than to your point, the brackets piece, which I guess maybe makes sense, but I haven't been trying to conditionally display things while also using that. My only thought, which feels more complicated than it needs to be, is that you have a variable for the screen and you have a variable for the decision, and they're different variables.
Yep.
There's probably a cleaner way to do it than that, but that's my 20-second impression.
Solution. That was my first idea too. I don't have a second yet, but the problem is you're asking users to click a checkbox or something else on the screen. That's like, the effect is if you check this box, then you'll see these other fields. But from a user perspective, it's just an extra click. And so it's not a great experience. So they should be able to just say, well, if I'm clicking row, it means I want to do something here.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't have a great solution yet. I'm still thinking through that.
I'm absolutely going to be playing with this after we record and trying to figure it out.
Yeah, maybe we can revisit that in a future episode if we come up with an elegant solution.
Yeah, yeah. But
I'm not there yet. I just have a burned hand, and I'm frustrated that I learned something because I'd rather not know this. That's not true. I'd rather know it, but I'd much rather have a solution for it, which I don't have yet.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm sure there's one out there. We will find it.
We'll find it. Eventually. I'll have to. So yeah, to be continued.
Yeah, exactly. So probably a data table plugin would have a solution to that. Just kidding.
Probably, but I don't get to use plugins, unfortunately.
Too bad. I'll have to bring up something I learned with data table plugins in a future episode. So
perfect.
Cool. Well, that's a good one. If we come back with a solution, like you said, we'll bring it up or post about it or something like that. So, well, Paul, you brought me an interesting topic, I think, too. So apparently you're running the show today, that you wanted to talk about. How do you keep up with what's new when you're billing most of the time? And I'm assuming you meant new in technology, new on the platform, those types of things, but I'm going to let you talk about it.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've been in this situation. I sure have too many times more times than I wish I had been in, where I tell a customer something is either totally possible or totally not possible, and then I find out later I'm wrong. And sometimes I'm wrong just because, I didn't know there was a way to do a thing, or the way I tried to do a thing never worked before and somebody has a smarter way to do it. Like, that can happen. But when I'm wrong just because I realize, that feature came out in a recent release, and then it's really exposed that, I'm just not up to speed on the latest release, whether it's, Salesforce or Certinia, that's a pretty embarrassing situation to be in, especially when you've been able to be confident for so long giving that same answer to the same question, and you find out, that's no longer true. And I really hate being in that situation. I don't mind being wrong if it's an honest mistake, but if it's something like, you're just not reading the release notes, you're just not keeping up, then that I'm not okay with. And yet, I'm trying to balance that with the very real fact that, I've got all these other incentives to bill as many hours as possible, and not just to bill the hours, but to to stay as productive as I can, to stay ahead of the project schedules that I'm on, if possible, right? It's part of, there's this pressure to just not fall behind. And I know that, well, if there's work I could do and I've got an extra 2 hours in a day to do them, I'm going to just get the work done. And there seems to be no end of the work. And so the obvious answer is, well, Paul, just take a day or a half a day or take an hour a day, or like these really easy answers of like, well, just take the time. And yes, of course, that's the easy answer. But in real life, it's really hard to carve out that time when you've got multiple customers. In some cases, people are like waiting for you to respond to them. And there's a backlog of like emails to reply to and documents to submit and deadlines on projects. Just kind of managing all of that to say, well, just take a few hours and read through it is fairly unrealistic. And then the alternative is, well, what if I just take a weekend and work a half a Saturday and catch up? Of course, that also is a good answer, but also not a great answer in terms of like work-life balance. So it's just something that's been on my mind. And I was curious if you've come up with a system that works for you where you feel like you're able to keep up on the new stuff without really compromising, you know, with your obligations on projects.
Yeah, I'll start by saying I don't know that it is embarrassing if you find out the system can do something that's new-ish that you didn't know it could do. If you didn't confidently tell the customer, no, it couldn't do that. If you confidently tell them, no, it can't do that, and then you come back like, yeah, that's kind of embarrassing. But I mean, I think in the consulting space, like here's always my frame of thought. Unless you're like going down the path, another path maybe. If you go down a path of a big customization for a customer because you told them the solution couldn't do it, and then get halfway through or to the end of the customization and find out, ooh, actually, we could have done that with core code. That would be very embarrassing. I don't know if you've had that happen. I have scoped customizations to find out a very upcoming release could do something that my customization was going to do. And I'm so thankful that I've always found out before I built or started the customization.
Yeah, I've done that. But usually I do it knowing that, hey, there's something coming on the roadmap. And you know, in discussing with the customer, they're like, well, if it's 6 months away, we do need some interim solution. And I've, you know, built it anyways in some cases. But
Or I like try to talk them into like a really light version of it.
Right. You know, or something like that. Right. Find some kind of temporary workaround. Would be ideal.
My point being, though, is, you know, to your point, you know, you're maybe incentivized on being productive or billably utilized, things like that. And while I'm technically not incentivized on that, like I'm generally speaking doing hourly contract work for people. So billing time is always better for me than not billing time. And that makes it a similar level of difficulty to prioritize anything that is not billing time, you know, from my lens. And so I've struggled with the same thing. I struggled with it when I was a consultant. I struggled with it as an independent consultant. And I found a couple of things that have helped, but I think that I'm always lagging in this department. The things that I found that have helped me are when I get assigned a new project, a big project, like start to finish project, carving out time to do the most current release training as part of preparing for that project. Because theoretically, I'm going to be taking that customer through some sort of requirements gathering, things like that, right? And it's helpful to know about any new features. And I'll say not only new features, but potential gotchas in new features and in implementation, so that if I'm presenting them to a client as I'm walking through like a detailed design or something like that, I can kind of understand, well, I might get caught here, or I might get caught here, or this isn't going to solve this type of requirement or that kind of thing. I'm not perfect, but doing that has helped. So timing new release training as part of getting a new big project. And the reason I say that is if I'm in a big project, oftentimes towards the middle or end of it, I'm not going to have that customer upgrading anyways. And so while they might ask me about new release functionality after they're live or different things like that, time is kind of on my hands there. But when I'm working with a new customer, I absolutely want to get them, you know, the best pieces of a new release that I can afford to get them if it makes sense with their requirements. And so that's been a place that positionally I found it makes sense for me to try to fit in new requirements. And I find that most of the time people, when you get a new project, are expecting you to have some prep time with it. Don't hear me saying that as I would bill it. That's a whole different conversation, obviously, but I would use that to build into my calendar time to kind of think about and prepare for the next set of requirements that I have to gather.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that. It's a good way to think about it because it's at least a trigger point that I can associate. Okay. New project equals prepare. Prepare includes, you know, spend time on new releases, get up to speed. And the crazy thing is it usually doesn't take that long to learn new releases. I mean, of course it depends on the product and how big the releases are and all that. But I find mm-hmm. that if I'm aware of what the feature is, like what it covers, what it addresses, but not necessarily the details of how it works, that's usually mm-hmm. enough to not trip over it in the future.
Fair, fair. Yeah.
Right. Like there's always time in the moment to say, oh, I think there's a new feature for that. Let me investigate it. And then you can spend the time to go right. deep into it and evaluate whether it's going to work for you. But it's that first step of recognizing, oh, we're covering a topic that was addressed in a new feature that mm-hmm. if you miss that flag and you just sail right through, that's when you risk like giving bad advice or giving an inaccurate answer. And so it's,
yeah,
those are I'm not embarrassed to be wrong. That's part of the job that comes with the territory. Right. But when it's because of something of just like me not keeping up, that's embarrassing. And that's,
you know, totally,
that's when I fail to live up to my own standards, whether anybody else calls me out or not, I'm going to feel that.
Totally. And I say that's not embarrassing, but like, don't get me wrong. When I do that, I think about it for like a month afterwards.
Yeah.
So I get it. Yeah. I get it. I mean, I think knowing a feature exists and knowing it's maybe not fully tested through or vetted from your perspective, like, yeah, it's always okay to say, hey, maybe let me do some reconnaissance, right? I'll do that all the time. And if I can test it on my own, I will. Or if I need to reach out to product, if it's a feature that has not yet come out yet, I'll do that, right? I have no issues doing that type of thing. Either. And also I think there's varying degrees of functionality that are maybe new and important, right? So product releasing new access to an API might not be as critical to my day-to-day project knowing as like, oh, we released new access to an API and we made that invocable in Flow. You know, that's something I'd probably want to know about. Mm-hmm. But there's like different types of changes that happen release to release. And some I think have varying degrees of importance that you would really need to know about, or you'll probably get there at some point and it's not as big of a deal.
Right. I've also found that there've been times when I'm discussing new release features, like with the team. So mm-hmm. earlier in my career, when I was leading teams, you know, it would come up in like a team, a regular weekly team call. Hey, there's a new release. How's everybody doing? Progressing on that? And if you can get the conversation started of like, has anybody seen anything in the new release that you're particularly interested in or curious about? And then somebody says, yeah, I saw thing. That sparks discussion. And then other people would say, oh, I didn't know the release had that. What is that about? And then they can explain it. And I've found that just that discussion, if you can find a way to facilitate it, sparks a curiosity. And for me, a lot of times my curiosity will override my sense of like being on the clock and being under pressure for deadlines, right? And I'm thinking, okay, I just need to take 30 minutes and look into this because I gotta understand it better. So
yeah,
that's almost a hack to get around my own.
Yeah.
Maybe discipline or whatever, or having a process. So.
No, I think talking about it's great. And the other reason I'll say that is like new features stick with me better when I have an applied use case. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I read a new feature in a release documentation, if I can't immediately be like, yep, I've had this customer, they would use this this way, and this is how it would benefit them, then I'd love to hear it from somebody else, because like, not that that happens often, but I'm much more likely to remember how a feature works and what it does if I have an applied use case to attach to it.
Right. Right.
And most of the times I can see a feature and kind of come up with that, but there's been times where I see a new feature and, you know, maybe I'm just not quite connecting the dots because I haven't had a customer with that specific need. Right. So
yeah,
I could think of an example, right? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, every release is a mixed bag. It feels like, you know, some maybe majority of features you're thinking, okay, that's nice, but it's not world changing. It's good to know. And then there's always a couple of nuggets in there that like, wow, this is really interesting. That's where I kind of want to spend my time.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I don't have a perfect answer, but those are some tools I've implemented to make it easier. I think the one that's worked the best for me is carving out time pre new projects. But I will also agree with what you said there. And anytime I can talk to people about a release or things like that, you know, maybe just get a different perspective on it, that's always beneficial too.
Yeah. So maybe one takeaway for myself is I can just bring it up more and reach out to my teammates and, hey, what did you think of the release? Have you had a chance to look through it yet? Or, you know, is there a good feature that I should know about? Just finding ways to maybe force it in conversation or bring it up. Maybe it can spark enough curiosity. But I think, you know, part of the reason that I brought this up, it's been on my mind lately because I don't think I've definitely got up to speed on some of the latest release with Certinia, but I know that there are dark corners in there that just makes me really uneasy because I've been focused on a different project. And so now that I'm heading into a new project, it is the perfect time, as you said, to do that for my prep time. But I've noticed that when I'm really focused on, let's say, one big project, or maybe I'm never working on just one project, but to the extent that I have a main project that I'm mostly concerned about, it's really challenging for me to kind of stick my head up above the fog and look around and get some perspective because I'm just so focused on the project, right? The dates, the deliverables. Right. Is it going to work? How is the customer feeling about it? And if they're concerned, if things aren't going well, then I feel like, well, that's just, I need to put in more hours. I need to do whatever I can, right? So all of my focus and energy is on that one project. And there's a kind of, I'm going to relate it a little bit to like depression. It's not depression, but in the same way, depression can make you lose perspective because you become, again, I'm not a psychologist, so please don't read too much into this, but you know, it's the loss of perspective that makes it challenging. When nobody is coming at you saying, what are you going to do about this new release? Right. And it's not in your face. It just tends to fall way down the priority list, but it's not the only thing. There's other things that can fall down in the priority list. When you get into the state that, I don't know, I would just say is part of mental fatigue, right? When you've been stressed from yourself, from customers, from your team, whoever it is, and it adds up and it's been a little too long and you're not getting clear and you're in that kind of fog of war or fog of projects.
Right, right.
That's where I start making dumb mistakes. That's where I start losing track of important things and losing, you know, my sharpness with prioritizing things isn't as good. So that's actually kind of related in some way because I see the keeping up as a symptom to a bigger problem. So let me ask you the bigger question, John. How do you manage mental fatigue or overall mental load, the kind of overload that we all are subject to from time to time?
Mental fatigue, I think it's a big thing in the workplace. It's specifically a thing in consulting. I feel like that gets talked about a lot, and for a lot of the reasons you just hit on and more, right? Like I think working too many hours, working on a tough project, working on too many projects, like there's so many things that can cause mental fatigue. Like I think so many people think it's just directly related to how much you're working. I think it's more than that. There's weeks that I've worked 35 hours or 40 hours and that doesn't happen often, but I'm exhausted at the end of it because the problems I was solving were really difficult or whatever. But you know, I think learning to manage it can be closely tied to work-life balance, but I don't know that it's fully that, right? And the reason I say that is let's say I work 8 to 5, right? And I'm at my computer from 8 to 5, or let's say it's 8 to 6 or 8 to 7. It doesn't really matter. It, to me, and I'm curious if you agree, like mental fatigue for me is like when I'm so tired that when I shut my computer down, I either can't escape thinking about work because of the fatigue of it, and or the work that I do, the quality of the work that I do, maybe lessens as a result of it. And so I think some tools that I've implemented, and I think I'm getting better at this over time. The first one that I want to talk about, I'm curious if you've done this, is like at the end of the day, I'll take, you know, 10, 15 minutes to just kind of write down a little bit about what I did that day. And then more importantly, what I need to do the next, like what's left, what didn't I finish? And I found that that's a tool that helps me clear my mind quicker to hopefully maybe recover faster for the next day. Right. Cause I look at like working when you're working on really complex stuff or working on a lot of things, like you need recovery time the same way you do when you're working out. Right. So if you don't step away from your computer, and able to start that recovery quickly, then you don't get to where you need to be for the next day, right? And so that's one tool that I've implemented that's helped me, is kind of writing down things I need to do for the next. I'm not good at that tool, but when I do it, it does really work.
So can I ask you a question about that? I'm curious the level of detail you go into when you write down what you did and what is left to do. Is it like bullet point level, or do you ever go to paragraph level? Like how detailed is it for you?
I'd say it's usually bullet point format, although I could see some value in paragraph in certain cases. Usually bullet point actions. Like I might break it out by client. I need to do XYZ tomorrow to be successful. Right. And again, not breaking it down into detail, but just kind of outlining it so that hopefully when I step away, I can start that mental recovery process faster.
Interesting. I know you've got more, but that reminds me of a job I had a long time ago. Way before I was in tech, even I had a job where the first thing I had to do in the day was there was a stack of sheets. You grab a sheet for the day, you put your name, you date it. And yeah. It was just a list of things. There was just two columns. The first column, you put an A, B, or C in terms of priority. And the second column, you put everything that you had to do that day. So you first just list everything out that you can think of that needs to be done. And then you put an A, B, yeah. or C by it. And then at the end of the day, first of all, you keep it out, is what we did. Like, because it was an office, and I'd walk around and I'd just see it. And then I would just go through the A's, then the B's, and then the C's if I could. Yep. And then if any C's were left the next day, it would have to be a B and so on. And having that prioritized list of stuff in my face throughout the day made that kind of work much more manageable. Because it was kind of a chaotic office environment where there's lots of administrative things to do and walking around and working with all kinds of people. And so that was and for some reason I've forgotten about that until just now.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, no, I think there's a validity to it, right? I've thought about taking it a step further and like at the beginning of a week, writing down all the important things I have to do and like when pulled away from those things, like really stopping and actually pausing and asking yourself the question, like, is this actually translating towards the bigger goal of what I need to do for the week? And it's not that you should immediately say no to it, but it's pretty amazing if you actually track your time at a detailed level, which a lot of consultants do. It's also interesting to track time that's not necessarily trackable, right? Because you can sometimes spend time on things that aren't really actually adding value. And then you have to ask your question of like, okay, is this increasing my mental fatigue? Should I cut that out? You know? I haven't done that, but I've thought about doing that. So, a second thing that I've done, I'm better about this in the summer, because it's nicer out. I live in the cold in Wisconsin, you know, although I don't mind the cold, but, is taking a minute between a meeting when a minute exists to, we live out in the country, walk to the mailbox and back is probably all of 3 minutes. It's not long. Doing that just to get some fresh air, right? Step away for a second, try to not think about work, try to not respond to Slack messages on my phone, although sometimes I do that and kind of defeats the purpose. That's another thing for me. I'll step that up further. When I am actively working out, I find that that helps with my mental fatigue as well.
Yeah, I've been, so I listened to Andrew Huberman's podcast, Huberman Lab. It's a super popular podcast science and how to apply science to your everyday life. And I've picked up a few things from that that I've been really putting into practice lately. And one of them is getting outside first thing in the morning before I start my day. Although that's much tougher with the time change now because the sun rises at 8:45 now. It'll get earlier, but now it doesn't quite work out to do that first thing. But just going for a short walk for like 10 or 15 minutes to just get some sunshine and kind of reset. And there's a few other things that he recommends that have you know, doing them consistently for a while now has really helped my ability to focus. And some of us struggle with focus more than others. But, you know, when I've got Slack open and people coming at me all day, every day with various questions,
right,
you don't know how urgent they are until you read them, right? So some things I can put off and some things I can't. But getting myself in that state of mind first thing in the morning with a little bit of exercise and some sunlight has made a huge difference for me. So.
Yeah. I think that's a really big thing, right? I know we're kind of living in a culture where people are much more like, hey, we need to talk about how activity correlates to mental health. And we need to talk about how, you know, sitting all day isn't good for you and staring at a computer. But like, I don't know, putting that into practice when I actually do is a big, big game changer. I'm not always perfect about it. I've been lacking lately with a 10-month-old in the house, but you know, I do find that helps a lot. That helps a lot. And that kind of coincides with, you know, intentional breaks from work, because it's easy to carry work into the night.
Yeah. And I've struggled with that over the years where, like you said, when you close the laptop or whatever you do to finish your work day, and then you go in, if you work from home like we do, and then I just step out of my office and then I'm home, there's no commute to transition. And so it takes me a while to feel, you know, to kind of let go of whatever I'm carrying work-wise until I can just relax. One of the things I've noticed that's helped me with that is I failed to recognize how much of an impact context switching actually has on me. Because in the moment, it feels like, oh, I don't mind the distraction. I'm alert. I'm ready. I'm feeling good. I can handle the distraction. I can respond to this while I'm doing something else. I can have three different Slack threads going while I'm billing, right? But the problem is that I've only begun to recognize, you know, fairly recently in my career and in myself, is that actually adds more weight at the end of the day than most other things I do. Whereas if I'm just focused on, like, I do two big tasks in a day and that's it, and maybe I catch up on emails once a day or something like that, I feel way lighter than if I did 12 things in a day. And then I just feel mentally cloudy after a day like that.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think there's a lot to be said about, even sometimes in the consulting space, setting unrealistic expectations for yourself. So we talk about effort to like do things for customers, right? And usually that effort takes place in forms of hours. But if I have 4 2-hour things I need to get done in a day, I can't just do that from 8 to 10, 10 to noon, noon to 2, 2 to 4, 4, right? Like that's not how that works. And so, I think sometimes we put too much pressure on ourselves to get 8 hours of 2 2-hour or 4 2-hour tasks done in a day. And it's like between meetings, to your point, context switching and things like that. Like that's not a realistic day in the world of someone that's primarily customer facing.
Yeah. When you said that, my first thought was, no, that's a 10-hour day. That's not an 8-hour day.
Yeah. Or more, right?
it can very easily be more. Yeah. It's like the more, the higher the quantity of tasks I have to do, the longer the day is, even though the sum of the task time is the same. I lose.
Right.
And the crazy thing is, it's like I've read about this for years. It's not new information for me, but I've always felt, well, I'm less subject to that than most people. And I was just wrong. That's just arrogant. I'm really subject to it because even in the moment, I feel like I'm being effective at context switching. I fail to recognize, even if I can for some stretch of time, it weighs me down and it clouds my thinking. And I really don't think as clearly as I should if I were being more responsible and more protective of my time.
I agree. I'll say that, like, I think I'm okay at doing it. Like, I truly do think I'm okay at doing it, but I will add to that, I don't think it's good for me to do it long term. And I think the longer I do it, the bigger of a toll it takes on me personally. And then also, to your point, the work that I'm doing. So it's like, I say I'm okay at doing it, but it's in a short-term context. Right. And I think the more people rely on you, sometimes the more that mental load increases, right? Because you get more pings during the day and things like that, that kind of require you to pull attention away.
Right. Right. Yeah. I've gotten to the point because that's the nature of my role at Certinia currently is, you know, people come to me for support with various things. And part of my job is, well, I have to be responsive. I can't just ignore everybody and say, tough, I'm on a project. Like, that's not the way my job is defined. But I also can't say, no problem, I'll put everything down because you have a question right now. There has to be some middle ground. And so what I've basically done is I've trained most of the people who come to me for help is I just say, just put 30 minutes on my calendar. If it's on my calendar, I'll show up. And I only do that with, you know, the colleagues where, you know, that's part of my role. That's not an open invitation for everybody, but at least I don't have to try to answer in real time or try to say, let me take a look and why don't you show me and give me 5 minutes. And, you know, those are really bad habits I'm still getting over. Mm.
I give myself too many follow-ups in meetings. The better I've gotten at reducing the number of follow-ups I give myself to that, to your point of like, oh, give me 5 minutes. Like, that's another thing that can reduce mental load.
Yeah.
I think that's where you're going with that anyways.
It definitely is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the last one I'll share and then if you've got any, but and this is not applicable to everyone, so I apologize. This is me, luxury of being independent. I've implemented not a firm, but I would say semi-firm no Friday meeting policy. So I would say, you know, it's not uncommon for me to have a meeting here or there on a Friday, but most of the time I keep my Fridays fairly clear of meetings. And a lot of people are like, oh, you just don't work on Fridays. How nice that must be. And sure, sometimes I don't work on Fridays if I had a very mentally exhausting week and I work on Saturday instead, but like I'm not getting work done. I'm still doing it. But what I found is that has helped me go into the weekend more clear-minded because I can take time to kind of catch up on my week, get some, you know, maybe bigger things done that do take those 2 to 3 hour frames of focus that frankly I used to do from like 9 to midnight, which is just not really that healthy. And I've started squeezing some of those types of things into Fridays. Don't get me wrong. Still pull those 9 to midnight shifts sometimes or later, unfortunately, but I found that it reduces that and also has found that it kind of lets me, in some regards, debrief from the week and get things done that are going to be valuable to get done without meetings on my calendar.
Yeah, I've had a number of customers who've had that no Friday meeting policy. I don't know if it's true that it's becoming more common, but I've certainly noticed it more in the last couple of years.
Oh, I've seen it more. Yeah, I don't think I would have ever been brave enough to do it if I hadn't seen it.
Yeah. Well, I hope it continues to become more popular because I think everybody benefits from it. It's like, okay, well, John, if I can't meet with you, that means that's one more meeting that I'm not having either, and then it'll hopefully spread.
I truly think it should become a norm. I mean, in the type of work that we do, especially that's like very heavily thought work, it's kind of impossible to not imagine having some level of uninterrupted focus time to do that thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and we think on the fly all the time, right? We're good at it, but like it's good to have breaks of like, oh, I actually have a 4-hour period to focus.
Well, those 4-hour blocks that you're talking about, 9 to midnight or 1 or 2, like I've done more than my share of those over the years. And part of why I did them was because I appreciated the fact that nobody's going to interrupt me. Nobody's going to slack me. Like I can just focus.
Right.
And it's so tempting. And like you, I do it when I have to, but I do it far, far less than I used to. And that's really helped. But in order to make that happen, to not be subject to those late nights, that means that I have to be pretty good about clearing my own calendar and sticking with it. Where when people say, do you really have a 4-hour meeting on Thursday? Your calendar is blocked off. And I'm like, yeah, I really do. I can't meet during that time. And if you're good about protecting that, which I'm not perfect, but getting better, then I can actually settle in for a good 3-4 hour work session, which is when I do my best work. Because a lot of times, you know, the kind of work that you and I are doing, a lot of design work and solving new problems for the first time and making sure everything fits together, it does require a lot of mental focus.
And you can't do it in disconnected hours here and there.
No, you really can't. You're going to overlook the quality is just going to be terrible.
Well, one of two things is going to happen, if not both, right? To your point, the quality. And then the other thing is like, let's say I can write a system design in 30 hours. Well, if I'm doing that in hours here and there, that's now going to take 50, 60 to get it done to the same quality.
And it's more likely to be incoherent. Because if you're writing page 15 of a design document in the same session that you wrote page 5, then it's going to be a lot more coherent. But if it's been 3 weeks since you wrote page 5, And that's really frustrating when I go through my design and I'm like, man, why didn't I catch this? I thought I thought of everything. I just didn't see how this piece fit in. Well, it was probably I was distracted is what it was.
Yeah. I find that the faster I can write the first iteration of a design in, it takes a lot of cleanup, but it's always better. It's always better. Yeah. Yep.
Definitely.
So anyways, those are some things I've done. I'm still a work in progress on that front. I still work late into the night all too often, but it's probably less than I was doing 2 years ago. So I guess an improvement on that front.
Yeah, I was always, for years in my career, I had the reputation, actually, my first consulting job, I was on the West Coast and my boss was on the East Coast. She was a very early riser and I was a night owl. And so I would often see her come online when I was still like up at 2 a.m. and it'd be 5 a.m.
Yeah.
I'd see, she's online. That's a bad sign. I should probably go to bed. And it was like something that we would joke about and it, you know, she didn't have a problem with it because I got my work done. But what I found was the fact that I would do that would make me slower the next day, not get enough sleep. Mm-hmm. Then the next day I'm struggling. Yeah. And then it's like 4 o'clock and I've hit the wall and I'll say, oh, I'll just finish my day tonight when it's quiet. And it became a habit.
Right.
And
that to me is the bigger problem.
Yep.
Doing a late night every once in a while is fine. But when you start making a habit of it, which happens quicker than people think.
Yep.
I mean, man, there is a year in my life where I was probably working till 3 a.m. at least one night a week.
Same.
And that is not good for anybody.
No.
So, yeah. Well, it sounds like we've got a whole nother podcast on, like, you know, being a workaholic at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a two-edged sword because I like, on one hand, I feel really, really lucky to have found work that I really care about and enjoy. Like,
same.
And for a big part of my life, I didn't have that, right? I found consulting relatively late in my career, compared to a lot of people that I've known and work with. And I just feel so lucky because before I would just constantly feel frustrated when I was doing other types of work and just feeling this, like, what is wrong with me? Why haven't I figured out what I want to do? And why do I hate my work so much? And so to go from that to something that I just truly is just inherently enjoyable most of the time is fortunate. Right. But then, you know, the dark side of that is sometimes I can do it too much.
Yeah.
At the expense of other people around me.
Right. Or I convinced myself the same as you that working late at night was what gave me focus. I think I thought I was just good at working at night, but I think you're right. I wasn't being interrupted. Right. And that was the thing for me. So, but all right. Well, yeah, lots of things to learn there. I'm sure it's something we'll talk about again because it is a pretty prevalent topic in the space. But I think we should transition, Paul, to a round we didn't do last week. We might do next week. And we want to call it the lightning round. I think we might have talked about it briefly last week. I can't remember.
I am totally psyched for this lightning round, John.
Yeah.
You have something that you're going to run by me?
Yeah, I've got some questions for you. And like Salesforce Lightning, I expect you to respond lightning fast.
All right. I'll respond with equal speed. How about that?
All right. I've got three questions for you here. I'm curious which ones you'll know. I think you'll know a handful of them. So the first one, we're starting off with the hardest one. What's the maximum number of scheduled triggered flow interviews you can have in a 24-hour period in Salesforce?
Scheduled triggered flow in a 24-hour period. I think I'm going to guess 200.
Okay, so this number blew my mind. It's 250,000 or the number of user licenses in your org multiplied by 200.
Scheduled triggered flows, but that's flow interviews, right?
Interviews. Okay. Interviews.
I was thinking scheduled flows, but scheduled flow.
Interviews. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
That still seems like a lot, though.
That's a lot. That's a big number.
I mean, I'd have to break down a flow to think about it, but that's a good amount.
Yeah.
To be fair, it is or 200 times number of licensed user count, whichever one is greater. So.
And I never get straight in my mind the flow interview versus the flow transaction.
I
have a cheat sheet I have to look at when I'm thinking about limits.
Oh, do you really? Nice. You should share that.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see it.
We'll do.
So. All right. So the next one, I'm going to try to explain this question in a way that makes sense. So if you don't get it, you can ask a clarifying question. How do you iterate through a loop in flow when you don't actually have a collection of records that you're iterating on?
Well, you can iterate through things that aren't record collections, any kind of variable collection you can iterate on. Is that your question? Like you just gather like a text variable collection?
Yeah, you got me.
All right.
Got me. You can also make loops. Have you ever done that?
Make loops. Oh, like so with a decision.
With a decision?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So like you can check counters. That's a fun one. Like if you have nothing, I'm not going to go too far into the weeds, but if you just have like a count you need to iterate against and you're adding count to it based on how you go through the collection.
Yep.
You can, that's a fun one.
It is a fun one.
All right. Well, you're doing good so far here. All right. If you delete a scheduled flow and scheduled jobs, will it only delete the next instance of the scheduled flow or will the scheduled flow never run again?
The scheduled flow will never run again unless you have paused flow interviews those will continue to run. But if actually you can't delete a flow if you still have paused flow interviews or even failed flow interviews. You have to delete all those first and then you can delete the flow.
And then no, not deleting the flow. Sorry. So in scheduled jobs, if you like go in there and delete the flow instead of on scheduling it by just deactivating the flow.
Oh, I've never done that. I've never done it that way before. I don't know why I would delete the scheduled job instead of just inactivate the flow.
To be honest, I wouldn't either.
Okay.
But it was outlined as a consideration in scheduled flows in Salesforce help. So I decided to ask you to see if you knew.
Interesting.
I mean, it will never run again. Probably makes sense, right? Because when you look at a scheduled job in scheduled jobs or whatever, it says like next scheduled run, initial run, etc. So like when you delete it, you're deleting the whole thing, not just an instance of it. It did really make me ask the question though, who's deleting scheduled jobs that way? Because I feel like if it's in help, someone did it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the way I heard that question is, what would happen if you did a really this really bad idea? And I was like, well, that never occurred to me. So I haven't thought it through.
I was looking at scheduled flow documentation the other day because I was trying to find an answer to something. I don't remember what it was. And I saw that in there and I was like, I've never considered doing it this way, but now I'm curious if maybe Paul has and I just haven't.
Yeah, you thought, here's an opportunity for me to publicly expose my podcast co-host with his lack of knowledge. Thanks.
I mean, someone's probably done it. So
I think
I thought maybe it was you.
Yeah. No, it wasn't me.
Thought maybe they wrote the help article about you. Nope. You know, it's like the coffee's hot, Paul.
Okay. I feel like I'm hovering around like a D minus on this so far. So
I feel like you were not. Oh, the first one you were far off on. Hey, you got the second one, right? Yeah, it's a D minus probably. Yeah. Oh, well. You know, better luck next time. They were kind of weird questions.
Yeah. And the third one, I'm going to protest and say that was an invalid question, although technically not.
Yeah, fair. Hey, you got the second one right, actually, too. So I don't know. We'll get there.
All right. I'm going to give myself a C then.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a C is fair. Who knows? All right. Well, that's all I have for you today, Paul.
Okay.
Maybe I'll come up with some more creative questions next time. At one point, I asked you about like random Salesforce company facts, but I don't know where those went. So I feel like I can't ask them again.
No.
So
yeah, I'll find some that are sure to humiliate you next week. So.
Oh wow! Thanks. Don't worry. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, as always, Paul, it's been a pleasure. Look forward to another episode next week.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, John. Thanks, everybody, for listening in. If I give him the ball, he's going to find a way to get open and make a high percentage shot. You know, like he's an executor.
Yep.
But I'm not going to make him point guard.
Totally.